This is the Acting Up Podcast with your host, Allie Goodman. Hey, friends. Well, number five. Let's get into it. I want to first say that I've been really appreciative of so many of you who've reached out to me and just been there during this whole crazy process. Just a couple of you who've been following this. Eileen, my cousin, and Debbie, and Nan, and Meg, and Courtney, I know you're catching up. But I can't thank you all enough for reaching out and for just having my back and hearing me. It means a lot, and I really appreciate it. And the rest of you, I'm sure there are many of you who are listening, but just like, these are just people that have like, they've been like, with every single episode, I've been getting a message back, so I just had to like, appreciate it. Anyhow, I appreciate all your support and everybody that's been there for me, because the last episode was super tough. it was a tough episode, yeah. And it's interesting because between that was a Thursday and then going in back into my session on Tuesday, there was a lot of time in between there, right? So I had a lot of time to go through that experience and figure out like how I was feeling and really owning that. And I know I mentioned in one of the last episodes that I've been trying to actually name my emotions when I have them. And so I've been working on that. And this is important because I think it actually brings us back to the work is, yes, it's you go under and you have this experience and whatever, but the work is really what happens afterwards. The work is really what you do later, how you apply the new things that have happened, how I'm integrating, how I'm applying these things. And to me, that's really where the work is. The thing that the ketamine has done for me, I think so far, is helped to sort of clear the clouds a little so that I can get to the work. And I think it's an important distinction because as I progress and, you know, move past it, like tomorrow is my last ketamine session. I won't be having another one unless I have a reason to have another one. Like if things get bad again, or if my depression starts to go into a place that I can't manage it again, or I feel like I need like a booster or whatever. There are ways to take some measures to check and see whether or not I need to go back for more. But in general, the idea is that I now take what the rewiring has done in my brain and I utilize now the work that I have with my trauma therapist and really work through these issues. Now that I have a different way of kind of experiencing the world. So I really want to talk a little bit about that. So once I had that, you know, intensive episode last week with all of you, I experienced that. I had it out. I cried. I all that stuff, and thought it was sort of okay. It's time to like move on, and not move on, but like we breathed through that. We experienced it. We had the emotional moment. What I didn't expect was to have another one and a bigger experience. And I guess at this point, I'm trying to remember that not to have any expectations, because every time I have one, they get thwarted and it becomes something different. So let me back up. I learned about the accusations, allegations, whatever you want to call them. I believe them. So I'd say the victims of Andrew Cuomo, New York governor. And there were a few reasons why I got very triggered by this experience with him. And one of them is that he was so beloved by everyone. People loved him. I mean, I don't know if you saw these mugs that people had that were like homosexual. Like, it was ridiculous, like how beloved he was. And he always sort of, he always gave me sort of the creeps, but I didn't know why. And I thought it was just me making judgments on someone because of my own history and didn't really trust that instinct. And the truth is, I don't know if I ever would have really thought that through. And I kept thinking, well, everybody else loves him. Like, what am I missing here? And when the allegations came out and when all the information started coming out and I was reading up a little bit about it, what really struck me and what really got me like deep in the feels and made me angry and upset and just full of rage was the words that he used with one of the victims, the questions that he asked her about her sexual experience, her current relationship and whether she'd ever had sex outside of the relationship or would, or however it was that he was putting it. And I read it and I heard it because it was reiterated back on the news. And I felt my whole body start shaking because that inappropriate conversation is the inappropriate conversations that I was having when I was 18, 19, 20, 21 with my uncle and forward. And it wasn't that I was bringing them up to him. He was bringing them up to me. And he was telling me things that I shouldn't have heard about. And he was having conversations with me about the type of pornography he likes and asking me what I liked. Like, that's just not a conversation you should be having with your uncle, ever. It's just so creepy. So I think as I was reading about this and listening to it, I started to get really angry because I began to realize that there's this investigation and these women aren't being believed. And there's a whole circling the wagons going on where they're questioning and he's denying it. And he's using language like, basically, I'm sorry you felt that way. And I was enraged. I am enraged about it. But that night I was beyond, like, seething, angry, hurt, frustrated, just so full of anger, just with nowhere to put it. So I wasn't really sure what to do about it because I was feeling it pretty intensely. And I reached out to a couple of friends and basically told them, I texted it to them and said, this is how I'm feeling right now. And I'm just owning, you know, I'm naming it and I'm owning it and I'm mad. I'm really mad right now. I'm really, really full of rage right now. And explained a little bit why, and they all wrote back and were totally kind about it. You know, I'm so sorry. That sucks. I'm so sorry. I feel that way. You know, that's terrible that you're having a trigger that's reminding you of that. And John came upstairs and we were talking, and I was like almost spitting venom of anger. And I realized that it's not because I'm mad at Andrew Cuomo. I mean, I am. What an absolute jag off. And I hate what happened to those women. And I hate that they're having to go through this. But because I could identify so deeply with what they were experiencing, with this, you know, not being believed or being believed, but kind of being brushed off by it, it made me so angry at the people around me who maybe they heard, maybe they listened, maybe they even believed me, but they still did nothing, you know? And that feeling of having to have my own back every single time in my life when I go through these traumas or have gone through these traumas up till now made me so, I don't know, like so angry, because I shouldn't have had to do that alone. I still shouldn't have to do it alone. I shouldn't have to be in a position where I have to endure hearing about him or worry about going to a Thanksgiving dinner because I have to double check whether or not he's going to be there. Like, that shouldn't have to be on me. why is that my responsibility? Why is it always up to me to look out for me? I mean, granted, I'm an adult now, it's different, but like, it was up to me to look out for me when I was 7. Like, why? So I think I have a lot of that residual anger. So I expressed it. I expressed it out loud. I expressed it in text. I expressed it, you know, in writing it down. Like, I did as much as I could to kind of just get that feeling out of me. And I know that it was good that I did that. Like, I feel like that was, I sat in that discomfort. I sat in that anger. I sat in that sadness. I sat in that rage. And I could feel my throat starting to close and do that thing that it does, where it basically goes to shut off the valve, shut off the emotional explosion starting to happen. And I consciously said no to my throat. I was like, I feel you. I feel what you're doing. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to cut it off. I want to feel this. I want to have this feeling. I want to be okay with having these icky feelings, because that's the only way that I'm going to heal, I think, because it hasn't worked the other way. I've been trying that for X amount of years and it's just never done any good. So what happens if we open up our throat and we open up and we allow all of the feelings to come through? I described it to the therapist, like I would close the whole thing, my throat up with like it's a dam, like a levee that needs to break, but it won't break. And then instead of like it exploding, which I think is what happens sometimes with my going into fight or flight and all of that, I thought, well, what if I just take down some of these logs from the dam? What if I just like literally take them off so that the water can go over? And that's kind of what I did. So like I don't think the entire dam is taken down, but I got enough down that the emotion could go over it, the water could go over, and I could actually feel it in all the places rather than shutting it down in my throat. And that was progress. That was big progress. I also allowed myself to feel angry at the people that I love, still love. I feel like it's complicated because I don't want to have these angry feelings at them, but I also have never really experienced having my angry feelings at them. I've always put the dam up and tamped them down. So I think that's progress too, just having the feelings and naming them. Clearly that was important, clearly. So when I went in for my session on Tuesday, we talked and I explained the whole experience of having those feelings and the Andrew Cuomo thing and whatever. And I thought, I felt a little anxious, I think, just because I was having all of these emotions and I kind of didn't know what that was going to do for my session and how I was going to feel. And I said it out loud. I told her how I was feeling. And then the other important thing that happened was I thought I made sort of a breakthrough explaining what depression is to my family. My parents and my brother and I have sort of a weekly, virtual meeting, like FaceTime, Zoom. And we'd missed a few, you know, everybody's schedules was all whacked out, but we finally had figured out a time to get together. And so this was the first time that we were together in a number of weeks. And my mom was just questioning, like, so how is it going? Like, how are you feeling? You know, is it getting any better? And the questions were feeling to me like, well, are you better now? Are you healed? Are you going to be okay? And it occurred to me that my initial response was just to get annoyed and shut down, because that's usually what I do. And instead, I thought, let me attempt to explain this in a different way, because I feel like I'm not being heard, but I need to figure out how to be heard. So John had actually, he kind of came up with this analogy that it's similar more to like getting treated for a long-term illness like cancer. And then I took that idea and ran with it. And so this was kind of how I explained depression and this treatment that I'm going through right now. And the fact that I've tried X amount of medications, this is how I explained it to my mom. And I think it's it's a fairly valid way of explaining it, at least with my trauma and how deep and inculcated my trauma is with so many pieces of my life, whatever. Because I had said, I'm finally getting to a point where I'm starting to talk about these things that and really get into them. And she kind of cut me off and said, oh, but you've been going to therapy for so long. Like, you've been dealing with this, you know, for years. I know you have. And I said, sort of. Yeah. I mean, it's not like I've been denying these things are there, but I haven't seen the right therapist. She's like, so none of them ever helped you? I'm like, no, it's not like that. She's like, none of the medications ever helped you? And it's like, no, it's not like that either. It's that my brain is in a place where it doesn't respond to it for whatever reason. I'm just medication resistant, or I'm so deep down in this depression, or I have enough trauma in my brain that it's actually damaged the brain to a point where it needs to be healed in a different way. And so I was trying to explain, like, serotonin, and that's what normally, you know, medications give you. And I was trying to explain dopamine is what ketamine, the pathway that ketamine takes, so it's different. And I just could see that I wasn't getting anywhere. It just wasn't landing. And I finally said something like, well, you know, you could Google this. And she said, well, I'm going to wait until you're done with your treatments. And I was like, why would you wait until I was done? And then she said, I've been listening to your podcast. And then I went, oh, I guess you haven't heard episode 4 yet. And I gave her a trigger warning on that and said, you know, you may want to be careful. And I said, you know, I don't know how to explain this to you in a way, because she started asking me if I was taking this new medication that she saw advertised. And I was like, no, it's not like that. And I said, okay. And she kept saying, well, when you're done with this, are you going to be better? Are you going to be okay? And I said, Mom, you're looking at this like I've broken my arm and I got a cast and they gave me some pain meds and then it's going to set the bone right and heal and I'm going to be fine. That's not what's going on here. And I said, you have to think of it more like, and then I used John's analogy, and I said, like cancer, because they understand cancer. My mom has had cancer. My dad's had cancer. Everybody understands cancer. And I said, think about it this way. You find out that you have cancer. Well, you've been going to see a GI doctor, and technically you have cancer, you know, breast cancer. But, you know, the GI doctor went to medical school. He has all the same degrees up to the point of specializing. So he should be able to determine this when you went in for your colonoscopy that maybe you have breast cancer, but he doesn't know because that's not where his expertise is. So you don't go to a GI doctor when you find out you have breast cancer. You go to a breast cancer doctor. That's where you go. You go to an oncologist who understands about cancer. And so I said, what has happened to me is I've been seeing therapists that were good and good for just dealing with sort of stuff, but not really understanding how to deal with trauma. And it's a different path. It's a different way of treating. It's a different, there's so many other avenues, and it's a deeper kind of thing. Nothing, no disparaging any other therapists, but you just kind of, it's different. It's a different approach. I've never had an approach like this before. I started with my trauma therapist. And she said, well, then obviously she's not helping you. And I was like, no, let me explain. So I started seeing the trauma therapist after I got medication again. That, think about the medication that I was getting, the fluoxetine, the Prozac. Let's think of it like that's the radiation. So found out I have breast cancer. It's too big to operate. They have to figure out how to reduce it. So they start with the least invasive, which is radiation. Great. So the radiation does a little bit of good, but it doesn't do as good as they'd hoped. So then what do? Well, now, after trying different forms of radiation, they've decided that that's not the path that's working right now. They want to try something a little bit more aggressive. Enter ketamine, which is the chemo. So now I'm doing chemo. And the chemo is aggressive, and it's hitting the cancer, and it's really it goes in a different path than the radiation. It's a different way of attacking it and trying to help it. And for me, I look at the ketamine as like smoothing over the damaged parts of my brain, which is like not cancer, but, you know, the metaphor still works, I think. And once you finish your chemotherapy treatments, you don't like go back unless you need them, right? And the hope is that you'll have shrunk the cancer to a point that maybe you can have surgery and it will be more successful. And, you know, the oncologist will look at it and try, you know, a different thing, and hopefully it'll work that time. And that's basically what I'm doing with this ketamine. I said, the ketamine is my chemo. When it's over, let's hope that, you know, I don't have to go back in and get more. If I do, at least there's that treatment available that I can go and get like a booster. Like you could go back in for like, you know, instead of 6 rounds of chemo, maybe you go in for 3. You know, it's the same idea. And I said, basically, now that that's finished, I can do the really deep and important work with the trauma therapist that we were trying to do, but that I was not able to get through because the cancer was too big. So now we've shrunk the cancer. Now we have a manageable size, and now we can go in and try to do some real work. And I said, and that's what this is. So it's ongoing. Like I'm not depression free. You're not ever really can't. I mean, you can be in remission. You can be out of, you know, cancer, you can not have cancer again, or you could have your cancer come back in a different way. I said, so we're hoping that this is knocking it to the point where I can now get the surgery, i.e. working with my trauma therapist, and then we're gonna be okay. You know, we're gonna be on the right path. We're gonna be relearning. I don't think I ever really learned self-help skills in a way that, you know, boundaries and emotional expression and all of the things that developmentally were stunted for me because of the traumas that I endured from pretty much every main part of my life. Haven't gotten into the fact that I was in a domestic abusive relationship. I mean, that was a whole other side of things. I mean, and that's on the physical abuse side, and it's also on the emotional abuse side, but it's an entirely other arm of this thing that I haven't even attempted to deal with or work out, or hasn't come up yet in my ketamine experiences. Although I did have a recent dream where that boyfriend, ex-boyfriend obviously, was there. And that was interesting because I haven't seen him in my dreams in a long time. And the intimidation was there, but I was not terrified. And that was a very interesting switch. So that was very nice. That was like a nice realization when I woke up. Oh, yeah, Darren was there, but I wasn't terrified of him. So I wasn't happy he was there and I wasn't comfortable, but I didn't have abject terror. So that's a positive. So when I went into this treatment and I was going under, by the way, we did 35 and 35. So we did do the 2 doses again. Obviously, we had to up it because, you know, the tolerance factor. So they upped it by 5 for each dose. And they did the same thing where they came in 10 minutes in and she asked if I wanted to go deeper. And I said, yes. So I got the full amount, but in 2 doses. And it actually, I think, worked better for me. I think that's a better way to do it for me. My body just does better with that. And right before we started, the therapist asked me how I was feeling. And I was telling her, you know, my emotional state. And she's like, yeah, but how's your body feeling? I was like, I think I'm okay. I need to like shake some of this anxiety out. Or she said that. She said, I want you to shake some of the anxiety out. So we did. And I shook out like stretching and, you know, all that stuff and sort of shook my arms and hands. And I felt a little better. And I said, okay, we're ready to go. And the nurse practitioner came in, gave me my dose, and we were off to the races. And I don't remember much about it. Not that I don't remember because I blacked out. I didn't hang on to any real images. There were maybe 3 things I remember pretty distinctly. One, I remember being in my son Jordan's room, laying on his bed. The way we have it set up in his room right now is along the wall, he has these shelves and they're high up because he would stand up on the bed and try to pull things off the shelves, and I didn't want him to hurt himself, especially since it's over his bed. So we moved all the shelves up as high as they could go, but enough that he still had space to, but they're high enough that he can't reach them, which is kind of funny. So I was in my ketamine state, I was looking up at the shelves, the underneath part of the shelves, while laying on his bed. And then a little later, I was in Jackson's room under Jackson's bed. Jackson has a bunk bed set up where he has it's like a double bed and then going one way and then perpendicular is the top bunk, and the top bunk is a twin bed. So there's different shapes and size, whatever, underneath where your head is, the way the bed is set up, is under the bunk, and then your feet are outside of it. So you kind of have to dip your head under, and you can see the slats and all that stuff in the bed above. And that was what I was seeing when I was in Jackson's room. So I had that moment. And that was a little bit more, when I was in Jordan's room, it was a little calmer. Jackson's room was a little bit, there was a little more tension, I would say. And I don't know, that's just because that's where we are with Jackson sometimes. I mean, Jordan, we're also tense too. I mean, he's a two-year-old and they're always rough. And he has a lot of sensory issues. So just adding that to it. But for whatever reason, there was a little, just a smidge more tension when I was in Jackson's room and looking up, you know, from the bed and looking up at the bunk bed underneath. And then a lot of other things happened. I ended up inside a fabric again, which was interesting. It was different this time, but I was inside of it. I was actually being like folded in, which was cool. And it wasn't scary. It was actually pretty neat. And then I had a moment where I had an image of Andrew Cuomo, shockingly enough, and Woody Allen. And I saw them, they were static, just sort of like almost outlined images, but I knew it was them, in red. And how I talked about my dad, how he was sort of this like blown glass head that rose out of that rock wall, it was similar. They were sort of being put together by pieces in these big looming, ominous ways, both of these faces that I, you know because I'm very familiar with Woody Allen and clearly have seen enough of Andrew Cuomo lately. But this time, rather than me being static and the head moving, it was almost like I was moving as the heads were being built and I was above them looking down. I wasn't big. I wasn't scary. I was me, myself, but they weren't over me, you know? I was above them. I was not like I'd overcome it, but I definitely had more agency and a little bit more power. And that felt really good. You know, and then everything switched and I don't remember much after that. I think I had a memory of at one point as I was coming out, those of you who remember back in the 80s, 70s, 80s of Sesame Street, they used to do these little sand art things that were like little people that would like kick a ball around and made out of sand or what looked like sand. I don't know if any of you remember that. I had a few little images of that, which was really interesting. Ketamine is so, so odd. The most important thing about all of this is when I was coming out of it this time, first of all, I allowed myself the time. And I basically told myself, yes, you can feel yourself surfacing, but that's okay. Keep following the images, keep following the music, just let it take you. And when you're really ready, you'll know. Whereas I think I had been skipping those steps to get out because I'm like, oh, I'm clearly done. I should, you know, be done. And we had established a routine where I was going to keep the eye mask on. Even if I ended up taking the headphones off, I needed to keep the eye mask on because the music was still playing in the room. She could hear the same music that I was hearing in my headphones. It was just louder in the headphones. So I could continue to talk, but this way the music was still there, but it wasn't as intense in my ears. But the eye mask, keeping that on kind of kept me, first of all, it helped with the dizziness and the nausea. But second of all, it kept me in the ketamine state longer. And therefore I had to sort of live in that in and out of the world a little. And I think that was important for me because it's a little bit of out of control, but it's still knowing that we're surfacing and it's okay. So it was interesting. I came out and I was really much quieter this time. I didn't have a lot to say. I didn't have a lot of images that I mentioned. I didn't have a huge, you know, emotional experience. In fact, it was quite the opposite. I felt super calm. I felt centered. And I say that with a question mark because I'm an actor. I use my body all the time. I've heard, get yourself centered, center yourself, center your body, you know, all these different things. And I've always thought that I was doing that, but I never, ever felt it this way. There was like a calm in my body. There was a presence. I don't think I've ever experienced it in my entire life. I don't remember it ever, ever. It was so cool. And I just laid there and I could feel my hands on the chair. I could feel my legs on the chair. I felt my tongue in my mouth, very gentle, but I could feel the sides of my tongue on the sides of my teeth. And I had a weighted blanket on me still, obviously. So like there was something just about that whole experience that just, I felt really good. And I was still dizzy and I was still a little nauseous and all of that, but it didn't matter because I still felt like in my body and present. It was super cool. And so I lived in that for a while. I sort of like luxuriated in that. And we talked a little bit about what that felt like. And I said, I feel like grounded, but I can feel gravity, but I also feel like almost like you feel like when you're in water where you're also kind of weightless, but you know gravity is there. And then she came up with the word of buoyant. She's like, so you kind of feel buoyant. And I was like, yes, yes. There's still gravity. It still exists. And I still feel it. And I feel like I'm not weightless, but it's like I can move easier. It was so cool. That was amazing. And that stayed with me through the day. I mean, I went home and I took a nap, took a very long nap. And I woke up this morning. I was pretty tired today, but I did keep trying to go back to that. One of the things that she said was, you now know what that feels like. So you know what your tongue feels like in your mouth. You know what your arms feel like and your legs feel like when you feel centered. So you've experienced it. Now you can try to recreate it or remind your body how to get there again. So that's kind of that's the goal, right? Like the goal is to kind of find that more centered space. I'm also a little nervous that I won't, you know, I'll be honest. I'm feeling like, oh, there's that other shoe that's going to drop where I'm not going to find it again. But I also have a little bit more faith that I will this time, mostly because I feel like I'm now experiencing, one, I have some tools that seem to be working, that the naming my emotions, the recognizing when my throat is closing. Again, I'm telling you this, like, it's not like I didn't notice that that was happening before, but I also didn't know that it wasn't supposed to happen because it's always what happened. The shoving down that emotion and feeling my throat sort of like clamp up was literally second nature innate to me. And it wasn't until I was saying, but I'm naming this emotion, but I keep trying to squirrel it away, that it was a connection. And I guarantee you that probably wouldn't have happened without the ketamine and the work that I'm doing with my therapists. So by that nature, I think we're making progress. I'm making progress. And I think it's pretty cool. And I feel hopeful. And I feel like I'll find that centered moment again. Maybe not in such a, you know, spa-like way, but enough that I can be in the moment present feeling that and not waiting for the heaviness to hit. So that I'm back to this evil depression, or kind of like my body and my brain are starting to work together a little bit. And maybe I'm starting to tell, my brain is starting to tell my body that it's safe, that there's safety and it's okay, which would be really cool. As someone who has never felt safe, who's had to cultivate safety, but really never felt safe, that's a big deal. Man, trauma's a wacky wild thing, isn't it? I would be remiss if I didn't just give a huge shout out to John, my husband, and my therapists. You know who you are. There's just been a lot of work going on, and I think I have to stop expecting that I'm going to just not have bad days or not feel bad or not have down days or not have moments where I feel like I'm overwhelmed or I can't handle it or I haven't become proficient. I have to remember that I'm in learning mode. I'm not in proficient mode. I'm not mastering anything yet. I'm literally starting over, learning how to develop these emotional channels. And I have a lot more work to do. And that's okay. Thank you for listening and sticking with this. I really appreciate it. It's been a ride, my friends, so far. All right. So I'll take a deep breath. Let's take it one day at a time, 1 minute at a time, sometimes even 1 second at a time, and just hang in there. Solidarity, my friends. I love you.